It was all she had of her mother now that the Afghans were gone, and Lisi supposed it was her more humble version of the memory nook in Scott's office. It was a place where she'd stored all sorts of mementos from Scott and Lisi, the early years, the first decade of their marriage. Photos, postcards, napkins, matchbooks, menus, drink coasters, stupid stuff like that. How long had she collected those things? 10 years? No, not that long. 6 at most, probably less. After Empty Devils, the changes had come thick and fast. Not just the Germany experiment, but everything. Their married life had become something like the berserk merry-go-round. Sort of a pun there, she thought. Merry-go-round, merry-go-round. At the end of Alfred Hitchcock's Strangers on a Train. She'd quit saving things like cocktail napkins and souvenir matchbooks because there had been too many lounges and too many restaurants in too many hotels. Pretty soon she'd quit saving everything. And Goodma's cedar box that smelled so sweet when you opened it. Where was that? Somewhere in the house, she was sure of it. And she meant to find it. Maybe it'll turn out to be the next station of the Bool, she thought. And then she saw her mailbox up ahead. The door was down, and a clutch of letters was rubber-banded to it. Curious, Lisi pulled up next to the pole. She'd often come home to a full mailbox when Scott was alive, but since then her mail tended to be on the thin side, and more often than not addressed to occupant or Mr. and Mrs. Homeowner. In truth, this current sheaf looked pretty thin. 4 envelopes and a postcard. Mr. Simmons, the RFD3 mailman, must have tucked a package in the box, although on fair days he was more apt to use a rubber band or two to attach them to the sturdy metal flag. Lisi glanced at the letters, bills, advertising come-ons, a postcard from Cantata, and then reached into the mailbox. She touched something soft, furry, and wet. She screamed in surprise, yanked her hand back, saw the blood on her fingers, and screamed again, this time in horror. In that first moment, she was positive she'd been bitten. Something had climbed the cedar mailbox pole and then wormed its way inside. Maybe a rat, maybe something even worse. Something rabid, like a woodchuck or a baby coon. She wiped her hand on her blouse, breathing in audible gasps that weren't quite moans, then reluctantly raised her hand to see how many wounds there were, and how deep. For a moment, her conviction that she must have been bitten was so strong that she actually saw the marks. Then she blinked her eyes, and reality reasserted itself. There were smears of blood, but no cuts or bites or breaks in the skin. Something was in her mailbox, all right, some horrible, furry surprise, but its biting days were done. Lisi opened the glove compartment, and her unopened pack of cigarettes fell out. She rummaged until she came up with the little disposable flashlight that she had transferred from the glove compartment of her last car, a Lexus she had driven for 4 years. It had been a fine car, that Lexus. She had only traded it because she associated it with Scott, who called it Lisi's sexy Lexus. It was surprising how small things could hurt when someone close to you died. Talk about the princess and the smuckin' pea. Now she only hoped there was some juice left in the flashlight. There was. The beam shone out bright and steady and confident. Lisi shifted sideways, took a deep breath, and shone it into the mailbox. She was distantly aware that she'd folded her lips over her teeth and was pressing them together so tightly that it hurt. At first she saw only a darkish shape and a green glimmer, like light reflecting off a marble, and wetness on the corrugated metal floor of the mailbox. She supposed that was the blood she'd gotten on her fingers. She shifted farther left, settling her side all the way against the driver's door, gingerly pushing the flashlight farther into the mailbox. The darkest shape grew fur and ears and a nose that probably would have been pink in daylight. There was no mistaking the eyes. Even dulled in death, their shape was distinctive. There was a dead cat in her mailbox. Lisi began to laugh. It was not exactly normal laughter, but it wasn't entirely hysterical either. There was genuine humor in it. She didn't need Scott to tell her that a slaughtered cat in the mailbox was too fatal attraction. That had been no Swedish meatball movie with subtitles, and she had seen it twice. What made it funny was that Lisi didn't own a cat. She let the laughter run its course, then lit a Salem light and pulled into her driveway. Chapter 6. Lisi and the Professor. This is what it gets you. 1. Lisi felt no fear now, and her momentary lapse into amusement had been replaced by hard, clean rage. She left the BMW parked in front of the locked barn doors and strode stilt-legged to the house, wondering if she would find her new friend's missive at the kitchen door or the one in front. She never doubted there would be a missive, and she was right. It was in the back, a white, business-length envelope sticking out from between the screen door and the jamb. Cigarette clamped between her front teeth, Lisi tore the envelope open and unfolded a single sheet of paper. The message was typewritten. Mrs., I am sorry to do this as I love animals, but bitter your cat than you. I don't want to hurt you. I don't want to, but you need to call 412-298-8188 and tell the man that you are donative those papers we talked about to the school library by way of him. We don't want to let any grass grow under our feet on this, Mrs., so call him by 8 p.m. tonight, alt he'll get in touch with me. Let us finigs this business with no one hut except your poor pet, about which I am so sorry. Your friend, Zach. P.S. I'm not a bit mad you told me to go F myself. I know you were upset. Z. Lisi looked at the Z, which was Zach McCool's final bit of communication to her, and thought of Zorro, galloping through the night with his cape billowing out behind him. Her eyes were watering. She thought for a moment that she was crying, then realized it was smoke. The cigarette between her teeth had burned down to the filter. She spat it to the brickwork of the walk and ground it grimly beneath her heel. She looked up at the high, board fence that went all the way around their backyard, though solely for the sake of symmetry, as their only neighbors were on the south side, to Lisi's left, as she stood by her kitchen door with Zach McCool's infuriating, poorly typed missive, his smucking ultimatum, in her hand. It was the Galloways on the other side of the board fence, and the Galloways had half a dozen cats. They were called barn cats in this neck of the woods. They sometimes foraged in the Landon's yard, especially when no one was home. Lisi had no doubt it was a Galloway barn cat in her mailbox, just as she had no doubt it had been Zach in the PT Cruiser that had passed her not long after she finished locking up and left Amanda's house. Mr. PT Cruiser had been heading east, coming almost directly out of the lowering sun, so she hadn't been able to get a good look at him. The bastard even had the balls to tip her a wave. Howdy there, missus, left you a little something in your mailbox. And she had waved back, because that was what you did out here in Sticksville. You bastard, she murmured, so angry she didn't even know which one she was cursing, Zach or the crazed incunk who had sicked Zach on her. But since Zach had so considerately provided her with Woodbody's phone number, she had recognized the Pittsburgh area code instantly. She knew which one she intended to deal with first, and she found she was looking forward to it. But before she dealt with anyone, she had a distasteful housekeeping chore to perform. Lisi stuffed Zach McCool's letter into her back pocket, briefly touching Amanda's little notebook of compulsions without even being aware of it, and yanked out her house keys. She was still too angry to be aware of much, including the possibility of the sender's fingerprints on the letter. Nor was she thinking about calling the county sheriff's office, although that had certainly been on her to-do list earlier. Rage had narrowed coherent thought to something very like the beam of the little flashlight she had used to look into the mailbox, and right now that limited her to just a pair of ideas. Take care of the cat, then call Woodbody and tell him to take care of Zach McCool. To call him off. Or else. 2. From the cabinet under her kitchen sink she got a pair of floor buckets, some clean rags, an old pair of Playtex rubber gloves, and a garbage bag that she tucked into the back pocket of her jeans. She squirted Top Job into one of the buckets and filled it with hot water, using the sink's handheld spray attachment to make the soap foam up faster. Then she went outside, pausing only to get a pair of tongs out of what Scott had called the kitchen's things drawer, the big ones she used on the rare occasions when she decided to barbecue. She heard herself singing the kick-out line from Jambalaya over and over again as she went about these small, grim chores. Son of a gun, we'll have big fun on the bayou. Big fun, no doubt. Outside, she filled the second bucket with cold rinse from the hose bib and then walked up the driveway, a bucket in each hand, the rags tossed over her shoulder, the long tongs sticking out of one back pocket and the hefty bag in the other. When she got to the mailbox, she set the buckets down and wrinkled her nose. Could she smell blood, or was that only her imagination? She peered into the mailbox. Hard to see. The light was going the wrong way. Should have brought the flash, she thought, but she was damned if she was going to go back and get it. Not while she was strapped and ready. Lisi probed with the tongs, stopping when they hit something that wasn't soft but wasn't quite hard either. She opened them as wide as she could, clamped them down, and pulled. At first nothing happened. Then the cat, really just a sense of weight at the end of her arm, began to move reluctantly forward. The tongs lost their hold and clicked together. Lisi pulled them out. There was blood and a few gray hairs on the spatulate ends, what Scott had always called the grabbers. She remembered telling him grabbers was one fish he might have found floating dead on the surface of his precious pool. That had made him laugh. Lisi bent and peered into the mailbox. The cat had come about halfway and was easy enough to see now. It was a nondescript smoke color, a Galloway barn cat for sure. She clicked the tongs together twice, for luck, and was about to reach in again when she heard a car approaching from the east. She turned with a sinking in her belly. She didn't just think it was Zack returning in his sporty little PT Cruiser. She knew it. He'd pull over and lean out and ask her if she wanted a little hip with that. He'd call it hip. Missus, he'd say, do you want a little hip with that? But it was some kind of SUV and a woman behind the wheel. You're getting paranoid, little Lisi. Probably so, and under the circumstances she had a right to be. Get it done. You came out here to do it, so do it. She reached in with the tongs again, this time looking at what she was doing, and as she opened the grabbers and positioned them around one of the unlucky barn cat's stiffening paws, she thought of Dick Powell in some old black-and-white movie, carving a turkey and asking, who wants a leg? And yes, she could smell the thing's blood. She gagged a little, bent her head, spat between her sneakers. Get it done. Lisi closed the grabbers, not such a bad word after all, not once you made friends with it, and pulled. She fumbled the green garbage bag open with her other hand, and in the cat tumbled, head first. She twirled the bag closed and knotted the neck, since stupid little Lisi had also forgotten to bring one of the yellow plastic ties. Then she resolutely began to scrub her mailbox clean of the blood and fur. 3. When she was finished with the mailbox, Lisi trudged back down the driveway with her buckets in the long evening light. Breakfast had been coffee and oatmeal, lunch little more than a scoop of tuna and mayo on a scrap of lettuce. And dead cat or no dead cat, she was starved. She decided to put off her call to Woodbody until she had some food in her belly. The thought of calling the sheriff's office, anyone in a blue uniform for that matter, hadn't yet returned to her. She washed her hands for 3 minutes, using very hot water and making sure any speck of blood was gone from under her nails. Then she found the Tupperware dish containing the leftover cheeseburger pie, scraped it onto a plate, and blasted it in the microwave. While she waited for the chime, she hunted a Pepsi out of the fridge. She remembered thinking she'd never finish the hamburger helper stuff once her initial lust for it had been slaked. You could add that to the bottom of the long, long list of things in life Lisi has been wrong about, but so what? Big diddly, as Cantata had been fond of saying in her teenage years. I never claimed to be the brains of the outfit, Lisi told the empty kitchen, and the microwave bleeped as if to second that. The reheated gloop was almost too hot to eat, but Lisi gobbled it anyway, cooling her mouth with fizzy mouthfuls of cold Pepsi. As she was finishing the last bite, she remembered the low whispering sound the cat's fur had made against the tin sleeve of the mailbox, and the weird pulling sensation she'd felt as the body began, reluctantly, to come forward. He must have really crammed it in there, she thought, and Dick Powell once more came to mind, black and white Dick Powell, this time saying, "And have some stuffing." She was up and rushing for the sink so fast she knocked her chair over. Sure, she was going to vomit everything she'd just eaten. She was going to blow her groceries, toss her cookies, throw her heels, donate her lunch. She hung over the sink, eyes closed, mouth open, midsection locked and straining. After a pregnant 5-second pause, she produced one monstrous cola burp that buzzed like a cicada. She leaned there a moment longer, wanting to make absolutely sure that was all. When she was, she rinsed her mouth, spat, and pulled Zach McCool's letter from her jeans pocket. It was time to call Joseph Woodbody. 4. She expected to reach his office at Pitt. Who'd give a Looney Tune like her new friend Zach his home phone number? And she was prepared to leave what Scott might have called a hugely provocative message on Woodbody's answering machine. Instead, the telephone was answered on the second ring, and a woman's voice, quite pleasant and perhaps lubricated by that all-important first-before-dinner drink, told Lisi that she had reached the Woodbody residence and then asked who was calling. For the second time that day, Lisi identified herself as Mrs. Scott Landon. "I'd like to speak to Professor Woodbody," she said. Her voice was mild and pleasant.
"May I say what this is regarding?"
"My late husband's papers," Lisi said, spinning her opened pack of Salem Lights on the coffee table in front of her. She realized that she once again had cigarettes and no fire. Perhaps it was a warning that she should give the habit up again after all, before it could settle its little yellow hooks back into her brainstem. She thought of adding, "I'm sure he'll want to talk to me," and didn't bother. His wife would know that.
"Just a moment, please."
Lisi waited. She hadn't planned what she was going to say. This was in accordance with another of Landon's rules. You only planned out what you were going to say for disagreements. When you were really angry, when you wanted to tear someone a new asshole, as the saying was, it was usually best to just rear back and let it rip. So she sat there, mind a careful blank, spinning her pack of cigarettes. Around and around it went. At last, a smooth, masculine voice she thought she remembered said, "Hello, Mrs. Landon. This is a pleasant surprise." "Sawiza," she thought. "Sawiza, baby love." "No," Lisi said, "it's not going to be pleasant at all." There was a pause, then, cautiously, "I beg pardon? Is this Lisa Landon? Mrs. Scott Listen to me, you son of a bitch. There's a man harassing me. I think he's a dangerous man. Yesterday he threatened to hurt me. Mrs. Landon, in places I didn't let the boys touch at the junior high school dances was how he put it, I think. And tonight, Mrs. Landon, Tonight, he left a dead cat in my mailbox and a letter stuck in my door. And the letter had a telephone number on it. This number. So don't tell me you don't know what I'm talking about when I know you do." On the last word, Lisi batted the pack of cigarettes with the side of her hand. Batted it like a badminton birdie. It flew all the way across the room, shedding Salem Lights as it went. She was breathing hard and fast, but with her mouth wide open. She didn't want Woodbody to hear her doing it and mistake her rage for fear. Woodbody made no reply. Lisi gave him time. When he still didn't talk, she said, "Are you there? You better be." She knew it was the same man who replied, but the smooth, round lecture hall tones were gone. This man sounded both younger and somehow older. "I'm going to put you on hold, Mrs. Landon, and take this in my study." "Where your wife can't hear is what you mean. Hold on, please. It better not be long, Wood Smucky, or—" There was a click, then silence. Lisi wished she had used the cordless phone in the kitchen. She wanted to pace around, maybe snag one of her cigarettes and light it off a stove burner. But maybe this was better. This way she couldn't blow off any of her rage. This way she had to stay strapped so tight it hurt. 10 seconds went by. 20. 30. She was preparing to hang up when there was another click on the line, and the king of the incunks spoke to her again in his new young old voice. It had picked up a funny little hiccuping tremor. It's his heartbeat, she thought. It was her thought, but it could have been Scott's insight. His heart's beating so hard I can actually hear it. I wanted to scare him, I scared him. Now why should that scare me? And yes, all of a sudden she was scared. It was like a yellow thread weaving in and out of the bright red over blanket of her rage, Mrs. Landon, is he a man named Dooley? James or Jim Dooley? Tall and skinny, with a little bit of a hill accent, like Westford... I don't know his name. He called himself Zach McCool on the phone, and that's the name he signed to his... Fuck, Woodbody said. Only he stretched it out. Fuck, and turned it into something almost incantatory. It was followed by a sound that might have been a groan. In Lisi's mind, a second bright yellow thread joined the first. What? She asked sharply. That's him, Woodbody said. It has to be. The email address he gave me was Zach991. You told him to scare me into giving you Scott's unpublished papers, didn't you? That was the deal. Mrs. Landon, you don't understand. I think I do. I've dealt with some fairly crazy people since Scott died, and the academics put the collectors to shame, but you make the rest of the academics look normal, Woodsmucky. That's probably why you were able to hide it at first. The really crazy people have to be able to do that. It's a survival skill. Mrs. Landon, if you'll only let me I'm being threatened, and you're responsible. You don't need to explain that. So listen up, and listen up good. Call him off right now. I haven't given your name to the authorities yet, but I really think the police getting your name is the least of your worries. If I get one more call, one more letter, or one more dead animal from this deep space cowboy, I'll go to the newspapers. Inspiration struck. I'll start with the ones in Pittsburgh. They'll love it. Crazed academic threatens famous writer's widow. When that shows up on page one, a few questions from the cops in Maine will be the least of your problems. Goodbye, tenure. Lisi thought all of this sounded good, and it hid those yellow threads of fear, at least for the moment. Unfortunately, what Woodbody said next brought them back again, brighter than ever. You don't understand, Mrs. Landon. I can't call him off. 5. For a moment, Lisi was too flabbergasted to speak. Then she said, What do you mean, you can't?
I mean, I've already tried.
You have his email address, Zach999 or whatever it was. Zach991@sale.com for what it's worth. Might as well be 000. It doesn't work. It did the first couple of times I used it, but since then my emails just bounce back marked cannot deliver. He began babbling about trying again, but Lisi hardly paid attention. She was replaying her conversation with Zach McCool, or Jim Dooley if that was his real name. He'd said Woodbody was either going to telephone him or... Do you have some special email account? She asked, interrupting Woodbody in mid-flow. He said you were going to email him in some special way and tell him when you'd gotten what you wanted. So where is it? Your university office, an internet cafe?
No, Woodbody nearly wailed. Listen to me. Of course I have an email address at Pitt, but I never gave it to Dooley. It would have been insane. I have 2 grad students who regularly access the mail there, not to mention the English department secretary.
And at home?
I gave him my home email address, yes, but he's never used it.
What about the phone number you have for him?
There was a moment of silence on the line, and when Woodbody spoke again, he sounded honestly puzzled. This scared her worse still. She looked at the wide living room window and saw that the sky in the northeast was turning lavender. It would soon be night. She had an idea this might be a long one.
Phone number? Woodbody said. He never gave me a phone number. Just an email address that worked twice, then quit. He was either lying or fantasizing.
Which do you think it was?
Woodbody nearly whispered. I don't know.
Lisi thought this was Woodbody's chicken shit way of trying not to admit what he really thought, that Dooley was crazy.
Hold on a minute.
She started to put the handset down on the sofa, then thought better of it.
You better be there when I get back, Professor.
There was no need to use one of the stove burners, after all. There were long decorative matches for lighting the fireplace in a brass cuspidor next to the fire tools. She picked a Salem light up off the floor and scraped one of the long matches alight on a hearthstone. She took one of the ceramic vases for a temporary ashtray, laying aside the flowers that had been in it and reflecting, not for the first time either, that smoking was one of the world's nastier habits. Then she went back to the sofa, sat down, and picked up the phone.
Tell me what happened.
Mrs. Landon, my wife and I have plans to go out.
Your plans have changed, Lisi said. Start at the beginning.
6. Well, of course, in the beginning were the Inkunks, those pagan worshippers of original texts and unpublished manuscripts, and Professor Joseph Woodbody, who was their king as far as Lisi was concerned. God knew how many scholarly articles he'd published concerning the works of Scott Landon, or how many of them might even now be quietly gathering dust in the booksnake above the barn. Nor did she care how badly tormented Professor Woodbody had been by the thought of the unpublished works that might also be gathering dust in Scott's study. What mattered was that Woodbody made a habit of having 2 or 3 beers 2 or 3 evenings a week on his way home from campus, always at the same bar, a place called The Place. There were plenty of college-type drinking establishments near Pitt, some of them by the pitcher beer dives, some of them the smart bars where faculty and class-conscious grad students went to drink, the kind of places with spider plants in the windows and bright eyes on the jukebox instead of My Chemical Romance. The Place was a working man's bar, a mile from the campus, and the closest thing to rock on the jukebox was a Travis Tritt-John Mellencamp duet. Woodbody said he liked going there because it was quiet on weekday afternoons and early evenings, also because the ambiance made him think of his father, who had worked in one of U.S. Steel's rolling mills. Lisi didn't give a sweet smuck about Woodbody's father. It was in this bar that he had met the man who called himself Jim Dooley. Dooley was another late afternoon, early evening drinker, a soft-spoken fellow who favored blue chambray work shirts and the kind of dickies with cuffs that Woodbody's father had worn. Woodbody described Dooley as about 6'1", lanky, slightly stooped, with thinning dark hair that often tumbled over his brow. He thought Dooley's eyes had been blue, but wasn't sure, although they had drunk together over a period of 6 weeks and had become what Woodbody described as sort of buddies. They had exchanged not life stories, but patchwork pieces of life stories, as men do in bars. For his part, Woodbody claimed to have told the truth. He now had reasons to doubt that Dooley had done the same. Yes, Dooley might well have drifted down to the Berg from West Virginia 12 or 14 years ago, and probably had worked a series of low-paying manual labor jobs since then. Yes, he might have done some prison time. He had that institutional look about him, always seeming to glance up into the back bar mirror as he reached for his beer, always looking back over his shoulder at least once on his way to the men's. And yes, he might really have come by the scar just above his right wrist during a brief but vicious fight in the prison laundry. Or not. Hey, maybe he had just tripped over his trike when he was a kid and landed wrong. All Woodbody knew for sure was that Dooley had read all of Scott Landon's books and was able to discuss them intelligently. And he listened sympathetically to Woodbody's tale of woe concerning the intransigent widow Landon, who was sitting on an intellectual treasure trove of unpublished Landon manuscripts, a completed novel among them, according to rumor. But sympathy was really too mild a word. He had listened with growing outrage. According to Woodbody, it was Dooley who had started calling her Yoko. Woodbody characterized their meetings at the place as occasional, bordering on regular. Lisi parsed this intellectual bullshit and decided it meant Woodbody-Dooley bitch-fests about Yoko Landon 4 and sometimes 5 afternoons a week, and that when Woodbody said a beer or two, he probably meant a pitcher or two. So there they were, this intellectual Oscar and Felix, getting soused just about every weekday afternoon, at first talking about how great Scott's books were, and then progressing naturally to what a miserable withholding bitch his widow had turned out to be. According to Woodbody, it was Dooley who had turned their conversations in this direction. Lisi, who knew how Woodbody sounded when he was denied what he wanted, doubted if it had taken much effort. And at some point, Dooley had told Woodbody that he, Dooley, could persuade the widow to change her mind about those unpublished manuscripts. After all, how hard could it be to talk sense to her when the man's papers were almost certainly going to end up at the University of Pittsburgh Library with the rest of the Landon collection anyway? He was good at changing people's minds, Dooley said. He had a knack for it. The king of the Inkunks, looking at his new friend with a drunk's bleary shrewdness, Lisi had no doubt, asked Dooley how much he'd want for such a service. Dooley had said he wasn't looking to make a profit. They were talking about a service to mankind, weren't they? Prying a great treasure away from a woman who was too stupid to understand what it was she was sitting on, like a broody hen on a clutch of eggs. Well, yes, Woodbody had responded, but the workman was worthy of his hire. Dooley considered this and said he'd keep a record of his various expenses. Then, when they got together and he transferred the papers to Woodbody, they could discuss the matter of payment. And with that, Dooley had extended his hand over the bar to his new friend, just as if they had closed a deal which actually made sense. Woodbody had taken it, feeling both delighted and contemptuous. He had gone back and forth in his mind about Dooley during the 5 or 7 weeks he'd known him, he told Lisi. There were days when he thought Dooley was a serious hard-ass, a self-made jailhouse scholar whose blood-chilling stories of stick-ups and fights and spoon-handle knifings were all true. Then there were days, the day of the handshake being one of them, when he was positive that Jim Dooley was nothing but talk, and the most dangerous crime he'd ever committed was stealing a gallon or two of paint thinner out of the Walmart in Monroeville where he'd worked for 6 months or so in 2004. So for Woodbody, it had been little more than a half-drunk joke, especially when Dooley more or less told him he was going to talk Lisi out of her dead husband's papers for the sake of art. That, at least, was what the king of the Incunks told Lisi on that afternoon in June. But of course, this was the same king of the Incunks who had sat half-drunk in a bar with a man he hardly knew, a self-confessed hard-time con, the two of them calling her Yoko and agreeing that Scott must have kept her around for one thing and one thing only, because what else could he have wanted her for? Woodbody said that, as far as he was concerned, the whole thing had been little more than a joke, just two guys blue-skying in a bar. It was true that the two guys in question had exchanged email addresses, but these days everybody had an email address, didn't they? The king of the Incunks had met his loyal subject just one more time following the day of the handshake. That had been 2 afternoons later. Dooley had limited himself to just a single beer on that occasion, telling Woodbody that he was in training. After that one beer, he'd slid off his bar stool, saying he had an appointment to see a fella. He also told Woodbody he'd probably meet him the following day, next week for sure. But Woodbody had never seen Jim Dooley again. After a couple of weeks, he'd stopped looking. And the Zach 991 email address stopped working. In a way, he thought, losing track of Jim Dooley was a good thing. He had been drinking too much, and there was something about Dooley that was just wrong. Figured that out a little late, didn't you? Lisi thought sourly. Woodbody's drinking dropped back to its previous level of 1 or 2 beers a week, and without even really thinking about it, he moved to a bar a couple of blocks away. It didn't occur to him until later, until my head cleared, was how he put it, that he was unconsciously putting distance between himself and the last place he'd seen Dooley, that he had, in fact, repented of the whole thing. If, that was, it had ever been anything other than a fantasy, just one more Jim Dooley air castle which Joe Woodbody had helped to furnish while drinking away the waning weeks of another miserable Pittsburgh winter. And that was what he had believed, he finished, summing up as earnestly as a lawyer whose client faces lethal injection if he screws up. He had come to the conclusion that most of Jim Dooley's stories of banditry and survival at Brushy Mountain had been complete fabrications, and his idea of getting Mrs. Landon to give up her late husband's manuscripts was just one more. Their deal had been nothing but a child's game of what if. "If that's true, tell me something," Lisi said. "If Dooley had shown up with a truckload of Scott's stories, would that have kept you from taking them?" "I don't know." That, she thought, was actually honest, and so she asked him something else. "Do you know what you've done? What you've set in motion?" To this, Professor Woodbody said nothing, and she thought that was also honest. As honest, maybe, as he was capable of being. 7. After a pause to think, Lisi said, "Did you give him the number where he called me? Do I have you to thank for that, too?" "No, absolutely not. I didn't give him any number, I promise you." Lisi believed him. "You're going to do something for me, Professor," she said. "If Dooley gets in touch with you again, maybe just to tell you he's hot on the trail and things are looking good, you're going to tell him the deal's off, totally off."
"I will."
The man's eagerness was almost abject.
"Believe me, I..."
He was interrupted by a woman's voice, his wife's, Lisi had no doubt, asking something. There came a rustling sound as he covered the bottom part of the telephone with his hand. Lisi didn't mind. She was adding up her situation here and not liking the total. Dooley had told her she could turn off the heat by giving Woodbody Scott's papers and unpublished manuscripts. The professor would then call the madman, tell him everything was cool, and that would be that. Only the former king of the Inkunks claimed he no longer had any way of getting in touch with Dooley, and Lisi believed him. Was it an oversight on Dooley's part? A glitch in his planning? She didn't think so. She thought that Dooley really might have some vague intention of showing up at Woodbody's office, or suburban castle, with Scott's papers. But before he did, he planned to first terrorize her and then hurt her in places she'd never let the boys touch at the junior high school dances. And why would he do that? After going to such great lengths to assure both the professor and Lisi herself that there was a fail-safe system in place to keep bad things from happening if she cooperated? Maybe because he needs to give himself permission. That rang true. And later on, after she was dead maybe, or so grotesquely maimed she wished she were dead, Jim Dooley's conscience would be able to assure itself that Lisi herself had been to blame. I gave her every chance, her friend Zack would think. It was nobody's fault but her own. She had to be Yoko to the bitter end. Okay. Okay, then. If he showed up, she'd just give him the keys to the barn and the study and tell him to take whatever he wanted. I'll tell him to knock himself out, have a ball. But at this thought, Lisi's lips thinned into the humorless moon smile perhaps only her sisters and her late husband, who called it Lisi's tornado look, would have recognized. A smuck I will, she muttered, and looked around for the silver spade. It wasn't there. She'd left it in the car. If she wanted it, she'd better go out and get it before it got completely dark. Mrs. Landon. It was the professor, sounding more anxious than ever. She'd forgotten all about him.
Are you still there?
Yeah, she said.
This is what it gets you, you know. I beg pardon?
You know what I'm talking about. All the stuff you wanted so bad, the stuff you thought you had to have. This is what it gets you. How you feel right now. Plus the questions you'll have to answer when I hang up, of course.
Mrs. Landon, I don't— If the police call you, I want you to tell them everything you've told me. Which means you better answer your wife's questions first, don't you think?
Mrs. Landon, please. Woodbody sounded panicky now.
You bought into this, you and your friend Dooley.
Stop calling him my friend.
Lisi's tornado look grew stronger, the lips thinning until they showed the tops of her teeth. At the same time, her eyes narrowed until they were no more than blue sparks. It was a feral look, and it was all de Buscher.
But he is, she cried. You're the one who drank with him, and told him your tale of woe, and laughed when he called me Yoko Landon. You were the one who set him on me. Whether you said it in so many words or not. And now it turns out he's just as crazy as a shithouse rat, and you can't pull him off. So yes, Professor, I'm gonna call the county sheriff, and yes, sirree, I'll be giving them your name. I'll be giving them anything that'll help them find your friend. Because he's not done. You know it, and so do I. Because he doesn't want to be done. He's having a good smucking time, and this is what it gets you. You bought it, you own it. Okay? Okay?
No answer. But she could hear the wet sound of breathing, and she knew the former king of the Inkunks was trying not to cry. She hung up, snagged another ciggy off the floor, lit it. She went back to the telephone, then shook her head. She'd call the sheriff's office in a minute. First she wanted to get the silver spade out of the beamer, and she wanted to do it right away, before all the light was gone and her part of the world swapped day for night.
8. The side yard, which she supposed she'd go to her grave thinking of as the door yard, was already too dark for comfort, although Venus, the wishing star, had yet to make her appearance in the sky. The shadows where the barn joined the tool shed were especially dark, and the BMW was parked less than 20 feet from there. Of course Dooley wasn't hiding in that well of shadows, and if he was on the place, he might be anywhere, leaning against the changing hut by the pool, peering around the corner of the house where the kitchen was, crouched behind the cellar bulkhead. Lisi whirled on her heels at that idea, but there was still enough light to see there was nothing on either side of the bulkhead. And the bulkhead doors themselves were locked, so she didn't have to worry about Dooley in the cellar. Unless, of course, he'd broken into the house somehow and hidden down there before she got home. Stop it, Lisi, you're creeping yourself out. She paused, with her fingers curled around the handle of the BMW's rear door. She stood that way for maybe 5 seconds, then let her cigarette drop from her free hand and stamped out the butt. There was someone standing in the deep angle where the barn and the tool shed met, standing there very tall and still. Lisi opened the Beamer's rear passenger door and snatched out the silver spade. The light inside the car stayed on when she closed the door again. She'd forgotten that, how the inside lights of cars now stayed on for a little while, the courtesy light, they called it. But she found nothing courteous about the idea that Dooley could see her, and she could no longer see him, thanks to the way that smucking light was screwing up her vision. She stepped away from the car, holding the shaft of the spade diagonally across her breasts. The light inside the BMW finally went out. For a moment that made things worse. She could see only a world of indistinct purple shapes under the fading lavender sky, and she fully expected him to leap out at her, calling her Mrs. and asking why she hadn't listened as his hands closed around her throat and her breath rattled to an end. It didn't happen, and in another 3 seconds or so, her eyes readapted to the low light. Now she could see him again, tall and straight, grave and still, standing there in the angle of the big building and the small one, with something at his feet. Some kind of square package. It could have been a suitcase. Good God, he doesn't think he can get all of Scott's papers in there, does he? She thought, and took another cautious step to her left, holding the silver spade so tightly that her fists throbbed. Zack, is that you? Another step, two, three. She heard a car coming and understood that its headlights were going to sweep the yard, revealing him fully. When that happened, he would leap at her. She swung the silver spade back over her shoulder just as she had in August of 1988, finishing her wind-up as the approaching car breasted Sugar Top Hill, flooding her yard with momentary light and revealing the power mower she herself had left in the angle of the barn and the shed. The shadow of its handle leaped upward on the side of the barn, then faded as the car's headlights faded. Once more, the lawnmower could have been a man with a suitcase at his feet, she supposed, although once you'd seen the truth. In a horror movie, she thought, this is where the monster would leap out of the darkness and grab me, just as I'm starting to relax. Nothing leaped out to grab her, but Lisi didn't think it would hurt to take the silver spade inside with her, if only for good luck. Carrying it in one hand now, down by the collar where the shaft met the silver scoop, Lisi went to call Norris Ridgewick, the Castle County Sheriff. Chapter 7. Lisi and the Law. Obsession and the Exhausted Mind. 1. The woman who took Lisi's call identified herself as Communications Officer Soames and said she couldn't put Lisi through to Sheriff Ridgewick because Sheriff Ridgewick had been married the week before. He and his new bride were on the island of Maui and would be for the next 10 days. "Who can I talk to?" Lisi asked. She didn't like the close to strident sound of her voice, but she understood it. Oh God, did she? This had been one long goddamn day. "Hold on, ma'am," C.O. Soames said. Then Lisi was in limbo with McGruff, the crime dog, who was talking about neighborhood watch groups. Lisi thought this a considerable improvement on the 2,000 comatose strings. After a minute or so of McGruff, a cop with a name Scott would have loved came on the line. "This is Deputy Andy Clutterbuck, ma'am. How can I help you?" For the third time that day, third time's the charm, Goodma would have said. Third time pays for all. Lisi introduced herself as Mrs. Scott Landon. Then she told Deputy Clutterbuck a slightly edited version of the Zack McCool story, beginning with the call she had received the previous evening and finishing with the one she'd made tonight, the one that had netted the Jim Dooley name. Clutterbuck contented himself with uh-huhs and variations thereof until she had finished, then asked her who had given her Zack McCool's other, possibly real name. With a twinge of conscience, tattletale tit, all the dogs in town come to have a little bit, that caused her a moment of bitter amusement, Lisi gave up the king of the incunks. She did not call him Woodsmucky. "Are you going to talk to him, Deputy Clutterbuck?" "I think that's indicated, don't you?" "I guess so," Lisi said, wondering what, if anything, Castle County's acting sheriff could get out of Woodbody that she hadn't been able to pry loose. She supposed there might be something. She'd been pretty mad. She also realized that wasn't what was bothering her.
Will he be arrested?
On the basis of what you've told me?
Not even close.
You might have grounds for a civil action. You'd have to ask your lawyer. But in court, I'm sure he'd say that as far as he knew, all this guy Dooley meant to do was show up on your doorstep and try a little high-pressure sales routine. He'd claim not to know anything about dead cats in mailboxes and threats of personal injury. He'd be telling the truth, based on what you've just said, right?
Lisi agreed, rather dispiritedly, that it was right.
I'm going to want the letter this stalker left, Clutterbuck said, and I'm going to want the cat.
What did you do with the remains?
We have a wooden box thingy attached to the house, Lisi said. She picked up a cigarette, considered it, put it back down again.
My husband had a word for it. My husband had a word for just about everything. But I can't remember for the life of me what it was.
Anyway, it keeps the raccoons out of the swill. I put the cat's body in a garbage bag, and I put the bag in the orlop.
Now that she wasn't struggling to find it, Scott's word came effortlessly to mind.
Uh-huh, uh-huh. Do you have a freezer?
Yes.
Already dreading what he was going to tell her to do next.
I want you to put the cat in your freezer, Mrs. Landon. It's perfectly okay to leave it in the bag. Someone will pick it up tomorrow and take it over to Kendall and Jefferson. They're the vets we have our county account with. They'll try and determine a cause of death.
It shouldn't be hard, Lisi said. The mailbox was full of blood.
Uh-huh. Too bad you didn't take a few Polaroids before you wiped it all up.
Well, excuse me to hell and gone, Lisi cried, stung.
Calm down, Clutterbuck said, calmly.
I understand that you were upset. Anybody would have been.
Not you, Lisi thought resentfully.
You would have been as cool as a dead cat in a freezer.
She said, that takes care of Professor Woodbody and the dead cat.
Now what about me?
Clutterbuck told her he would send a deputy at once, Deputy Beckman or Deputy Alston, whichever was closer, to take charge of the letter. Now that he thought of it, he said, the deputy who visited her could take a few Polaroid snaps of the dead cat, too. All the deputies carried Polaroid cameras in their cars. Then the deputy, and later on his 11 p.m. relief, would take up station on Route 19 within view of her house. Unless, of course, there was an emergency call, an accident or something of that nature. If Dooley checked by, Clutterbuck's oddly delicate way of putting it, he'd see the county cruiser and move along. Lisi hoped Clutterbuck was right about that.
Guys like this Dooley, Clutterbuck continued, were usually more show than go. If they couldn't scare someone into giving them what they wanted, they had a tendency to forget the whole deal.
My guess is you'll never see him again.
Lisi hoped he was right about that, too. She herself had her doubts. What she kept coming back to was the way Zack had set things up, how he'd done it so he couldn't be called off, at least not by the man who had hired him.
2. Not 20 minutes after finishing her conversation with Deputy Clutterbuck, whom her tired mind now kept wanting to call either Deputy Butterhug or, perhaps cross-referencing Polaroid cameras, Deputy Shutterbug, a slim man dressed in khaki and wearing a large gun on his hip showed up at her front door. He introduced himself as Deputy Dan Beckman and told her he'd been instructed to take a certain letter into safekeeping and photograph a certain deceased animal. Lisi kept a straight face at that, although she had to bite down hard on the soft inner lining of her cheeks to manage the feat. Beckman placed the letter, along with the plain white envelope, into a baggie which Lisi provided, then asked if she had put the deceased animal in the freezer. Lisi had done this as soon as she finished talking to Clutterbuck, depositing the green garbage bag in the far left corner of her big trawlson, where there was nothing but an elderly stack of venison steaks in hoar-frosty plastic bags, a present to her and Scott from their electrician, Smiley Flanders. Smiley had won a permit in the moose lottery of 01 or 02, Lisi couldn't remember which, and had dropped a tolerable big un up in the St. John Valley, where Charlie Corriveau had bagged his new bride, now that Lisi thought of it. Next to the meat, which she would most certainly never get around to eating, except perhaps in the event of a nuclear war, was the only place for a dead Galloway barn cat, and she told Deputy Beckman to make sure he put it back there and nowhere else when he had finished his photography. He promised with perfect seriousness
that he would comply with her request, and she once more found it necessary to bite the insides of her cheeks. Even so, that one was close. As soon as he was clumping stolidly down the basement stairs, Lisi turned herself to the wall like a naughty child with her forehead against the plaster and her hands over her mouth, laughing in whispery, wide-throated squeals. It was as this throw passed that she began thinking again about Goodma's cedar box. It had been Lisi's for over 35 years, but she had never thought of it as hers. Remembering the box and all the little mementos tucked away inside helped to ease the hysteria bubbling up from deep inside her. What helped even more was her growing certainty that she had put the box in the attic. Which made perfect sense, of course. The detritus of Scott's working life was out there in the barn and the study. The detritus of the life she had lived while he was working would be here, in the house she had chosen and they had both come to love. In the attic were at least 4 expensive Turkish rugs she had once adored, and which had at some point, for reasons she did not understand, begun to give her the creeps. At least 3 sets of retired luggage that had taken everything 2 dozen airlines, many of them dinky little commuter puddle jumper outfits, could throw at them. Battered warriors that deserved medals and parades, but would have been content with honorable attic retirement. Hell, boys, it beats the town dump. The Danish modern living room furniture that Scott said looked pretentious, and how angry with him she'd been, mostly because she thought he was probably right. The roll-top desk, a bargain, that turned out to have 1 short leg which had to be shimmed, only the shim was always coming out, and then one day the roll-top had unrolled on her fingers, and that had been it, buddy, up to the smoking attic with you. Ashtrays on stands from their smoking days. Scott's old IBM Selectric, which she had used for correspondence until it started getting hard to find the ribbons and correct tapes. Stuff like a this, stuff like a that, stuff like a the other thing. Another world, really, and yet it was all right cheer, or at least right up dear. And somewhere, probably behind a stack of magazines or sitting on top of the rocking chair with the unreliable split back, would be the cedar box. Thinking about it was like thinking about cold water when you were thirsty on a hot day. She didn't know just why that should be so, but it was. By the time Deputy Beckman came up from the cellar with his Polaroids, she was impatient for him to be gone. Perversely, he hung on like a toothache, Dad DeBuscher would have said. First telling her it looked like the cat had been stabbed with some sort of tool, possibly a screwdriver, then assuring her he'd be parked right outside. It might not say to serve and protect on their units, he called them units. But the thought was there every minute, and he wanted her to feel perfectly safe. Lisi said she felt so safe she was actually thinking about going to bed. It had been a long day, she'd had a family emergency to deal with as well as this stalker business, and she was utterly whipped. Deputy Beckman finally took the hint and left her after telling her 1 final time that she was as safe as could be, safe as houses, and there was no need for any of that sleeping with one eye open stuff. Then he clumped down her front steps as stolidly as he'd clumped down her cellar stairs, shuffling through his dead cat photos a final time while he still had light enough to see them. A minute or 2 later, she heard what sounded like a perfectly huge engine rev twice. Headlights washed across the lawn and the house, then abruptly went out. She thought of Deputy Daniel Beckman sitting across the road with his cruiser parked prominently on the shoulder. She smiled. Then she went upstairs to the attic, with no idea that she would be lying on her bed, fully dressed, 2 hours later, exhausted and weeping. 3. The exhausted mind is obsession's easiest prey, and after 30 minutes of fruitless searching in the attic, where the air was hot and still, the light was poor, and the shadows seemed slyly determined to hide every nook she wanted to investigate, Lisi gave way to obsession without even realizing it. She'd had no clear reason for wanting the box in the first place, only a strong intuition that something inside, some souvenir from her early marriage, was the next station of the boule. After a while, however, the box itself became her goal. Goodma's cedar box. Boules be damned. If she didn't lay hands on that cedar box, 1 foot long, maybe 9 inches wide and 6 deep, she'd never be able to sleep. She'd only lie there tortured by thoughts of dead cats and dead husbands and empty beds and incunk warriors and sisters who cut themselves and fathers who cut— Hush, Lisi, hush. She'd only lie there, leave it at that. An hour's search was enough to convince her the cedar box wasn't in the attic after all. But by then she was sure it was probably in the spare bedroom. It was perfectly reasonable to think it had migrated back there. Except another 40 minutes, including a teetery stepladder exploration on the top shelf in the closet, convinced her the spare room was another dry hole. So the box was down cellar. Had to be. Very likely it had come to rest behind the stairs, where there was a bunch of cardboard boxes containing curtains, rug remnants, old stereo components, and a few bits of sporting equipment. Ice skates, a croquet set, a badminton net with a hole in it. As she hurried down the cellar stairs, not thinking at all of the dead cat now lying beside the pile of petrified moose meat in her freezer, Lisi began to believe she had even seen the box down there. By then she was very tired, but only distantly aware of the fact. It took her 20 minutes to drag all of the cartons from their long-term resting place. Some were damp and split open. By the time she'd finished going through the stuff inside, her limbs were trembling with exhaustion, her clothes were sticking to her, and a nasty little headache had begun thumping at the back of her skull. She shoved back the cartons that were still holding together and left the ones that had split apart where they were. Goodma's box was in the attic, after all. Must be. Had been all along. As she wasted time down here among the rusty ice skates and forgotten jigsaw puzzles, the cedar box was waiting patiently up there. Lisi could now think of half a dozen places she'd neglected to search, including the crawl space all the way back under the eaves. That was the most likely spot. She'd probably put the box there and just forgotten all about. The thought broke off cleanly as she realized someone was standing behind her. She could see him from the corner of her eye. Call him Jim Dooley or Zach McCool, by either name, he would in the next moment drop a hand on her sweaty shoulder and call her Mrs. Then she'd really have something to worry about. The sensation was so real that Lisi actually heard the shuffle of Dooley's feet. She wheeled around, hands coming up to protect her face, and had just an instant to see the Hoover vacuum she herself had pulled out from under the stairs. Then she tripped over the moldering cardboard carton with the old badminton net stuffed inside. She waved her arms for balance, almost caught it, lost it, had time to think shit a brick, and went down. The top of her head missed the underside of the stairs by a whisker, and that was good because that would have been a nasty crack indeed. Maybe the kind that laid you out unconscious. Laid you out dead if you came down hard enough on the cement floor. Lisi managed to break her fall with her splayed hands, one knee landing safely on the springy mat of the rotted badminton net, the other suffering a harder landing on the cellar floor. Luckily, she was still wearing her jeans. The fall was fortunate in another way, she thought 15 minutes later as she lay on her bed, still fully dressed but with her hard crying over. She was by then down to the isolated sobs and rueful, watery gasps for breath that are strong emotions hangover. The fall, and the scare that had preceded it, she supposed, had cleared her head. She might have gone on hunting the box for another 2 hours, longer if her strength had held out. Back to the attic, back to the spare bedroom, back to the cellar, back to the future, Scott would surely have added. He had a knack for cracking wise at precisely the wrong moment. Or what turned out later on to have been precisely the right one. In any case, she might well have gone on till dawn's early light, and it would have gotten her a lot of hot air in one hand and a big pile of jack shit in the other. Lisi was now convinced the box was either in a place so obvious she'd already passed it half a dozen times, or it was just gone. Maybe stolen by one of the cleaning women who'd worked for the Landons over the years, or by some workman who'd spied it and thought his wife would like a nice box like that, and that Mr. Landon's missus, funny how that word got into your head, would never miss it. Fiddle-dee-dee, little-dee-see, said the Scot who kept his place in her head. Think about it tomorrow, for tomorrow is another day. Yep, Lisi said, then sat up, suddenly aware that she was a sweaty, smelly woman living inside a set of sweaty, dirty clothes. She got out of them as quickly as she could, left them in a heap by the foot of the bed, and headed for the shower. She had scraped the palms of both hands breaking her fall in the cellar, but she ignored their stinging and soaped her hair twice, letting suds run down the sides of her face. Then, almost dozing under the hot water for 5 minutes or so, She resolutely